1970, if large average earnings and other important attributes made the stock look cheap. The enterprising investor may confine his choice to industries and companies about which he holds an optimistic view, but we counsel strongly against paying a high price for a stock in relation to earnings and assets because of such enthusiasm. If he followed our philosophy in this field, he would more likely be the buyer of important cyclical enterprises, such as steel shares, perhaps. When the current situation is unfavorable, the near-term prospects are poor, and the low price fully reflects the current pessimism. Secondary companies. Next in order for examination and possible selection would come secondary companies that are making a good showing, have a satisfactory past record, but appear to hold no charm for the public. These would be enterprises on the order of Eltra and Emhart at their 1970 closing prices. There are various ways of going about locating such companies. We should like to try a novel approach here and give a reasonably detailed exposition of one such exercise in stock selection. Ours is a double purpose. Many of our listeners may find a substantial practical value in the method we shall follow, or it may suggest comparable methods to try out. Beyond that, what we shall do may help them come to grips with the real world of common stocks and introduce them to one of the most fascinating and valuable little volumes in existence. It is Standard & Poor's Stock Guide, published monthly and made available to the general public under annual subscription. In addition, many brokerage firms distribute the guide to their clients on request. The great bulk of the guide is given over to about 230 pages of condensed statistical information on the stocks of more than 4,500 companies. These include all the issues listed on the various exchanges, say 3,000 plus some 1,500 unlisted issues. Most of the items needed for a first and even a second look at a given company appear in this compendium. From our viewpoint, the important missing datum is the net asset value, or book value, per share, which can be found in the larger Standard & Poor's volumes and elsewhere. The investor who likes to play around with corporate figures will find himself in clover with the stock guide. He can open to any page and see before his eyes a condensed panorama of the splendors and miseries of the stock market, with all-time high and low prices going as far back as 1936 when available. He will find companies that have multiplied their price 2,000 times from the minuscule low to the majestic high. For prestigious IBM, the growth was only 333 times in that period. He will find, not so exceptionally, a company whose shares advanced from 3/8 to 68, and then fell back to 3. In the dividend record column, he will find one that goes back to 1791, paid by Industrial National Bank of Rhode Island, which recently saw fit to change its ancient corporate name. If he looks at the guide for the year-end 1969, he'll read that Penn Central Company, as successor to Pennsylvania Railroad, has been paying dividends steadily since 1848. Alas, it was doomed to bankruptcy a few months later. You'll find a company selling at only 2 times its last reported earnings, and another selling at 99 times such earnings. In most cases, you'll find it difficult to tell the line of business from the corporate name. For one U.S. Steel, there will be 3 called such things as ITI Corporation, bakery stuff, or Santa Fe Industries, mainly the large railroad. He can feast on an extraordinary variety of price histories, dividend and earnings histories, financial positions, capitalization setups, and whatnot. Backward-leaning conservatism, run-of-the-mind featureless companies, the most peculiar combinations of principal business, all kinds of Wall Street gadgets and widgets, they are all there, waiting to be browsed over, or studied with a serious objective. The guides give in separate columns the current dividend yields and price-to-earnings ratios, based on latest 12-month figures, wherever applicable. It is this last item that puts us on the track of our exercise in common stock selection. A winnowing of the stock guide. Suppose we look for a simple prima facie indication that a stock is cheap. The first such clue that comes to mind is a low price in relation to recent earnings. Let's make a preliminary list of stocks that sold at a multiple of 9 or less at the end of 1970. That datum is conveniently provided in the last column of the even-numbered pages. For an illustrative sample, we shall take the first 20 such low multiplier stocks. They begin with the sixth issue listed, Aberdeen Manufacturing Company, which closed the year at 10 1/4, or 9 times its reported earnings of $1.25 per share for the 12 months ended September 1970. The 20th such issue is American Maize Products, which closed at 9.5, also with a multiplier of 9. The group may have seemed mediocre, with 10 issues selling below $10 per share. This fact is not truly important. It would probably, not necessarily, warn defensive investors against such a list, but the inference for enterprising investors might be favorable on balance. Before making a further scrutiny, let us calculate some numbers. Our list represents about 1 in 10 of the first 200 issues looked at. On that basis, the guide should yield, say, 450 issues selling at multipliers under 10. This would make a goodly number of candidates for further selectivity. So let us apply to our list some additional criteria, rather similar to those we suggested for the defensive investor, but not so severe. We suggest the following. 1. Financial condition. A. Current assets at least 1.5 times current liabilities, and B. Debt not more than 110% of net current assets for industrial companies. 2. Earnings stability. No deficit in the last 5 years covered in the stock guide. 3. Dividend record. Some current dividend. 4. Earnings growth. Last year's earnings more than those of 1966. 5. Price. Less than 120% net tangible assets. The earnings figures in the guide were generally for those ending September 30, 1970, and thus do not include what may be a bad quarter at the end of that year. But an intelligent investor can't ask for the moon, at least not to start with. Note also that we set no lower limit on the size of the enterprise. Small companies may afford enough safety if bought carefully and on a group basis. When we have applied the 5 additional criteria, our list of 20 candidates is reduced to only 5. Let us continue our search until the first 450 issues in the guide have yielded us a little portfolio of 15 stocks meeting our 6 requirements. They are set forth in Table 15-1, which can be found on the enhancement guide, together with some relevant data. The group, of course, is presented for illustration only and would not necessarily have been chosen by our inquiring investor. The fact is that the user of our method would have had a much wider choice. If our winnowing approach had been applied to all 4,500 companies in the stock guide, and if the ratio for the first 10th had held good throughout, we would end up with about 150 companies meeting all 6 of our criteria of selection. The enterprising investor would then be able to follow his judgment, or his partialities and prejudices, in making a third selection of, say, 1 out of 5 in this ample list. The stock guide materials includes earnings and dividend rankings, which are based on stability and growth of these factors for the past 8 years. Thus, price attractiveness does not enter here. We include the S&P rankings in our Table 15-1, which can be found on the enhancement. 10 of the 15 issues are ranked B+, equals average, and 1, American Maize, is given the high rating of A. If our enterprising investor wanted to add a 7th mechanical criterion to his choice, by considering only issues ranked by Standard & Poor's as average or better in quality, he might still have about 100 such issues to choose from. One might say that a group of issues of at least average quality, meeting criteria of financial condition as well, purchasable at a low multiplier of current earnings and below asset value, should offer good promise of satisfactory investment results. Single criteria for choosing common stocks. An inquiring listener might well ask whether the choice of a better-than-average portfolio could be made a simpler affair than we've just outlined. Could a single plausible criterion be used to good advantage, such as a low price-to-earnings ratio or a high dividend return or a large asset value? The two methods of this sort that we've found to give quite consistently good results in the longer past have been A, the purchase of low multiplier stocks of important companies, such as the DJI A-list, and B, the choice of a diversified group of stocks selling under their net current asset value or working capital value. We have already pointed out that the low multiplier criterion applied to the DJI A at the end of 1968 worked out badly when the results are measured to mid-1971. The record of common stock purchases made at a price below their working capital value has no such bad mark against it. The drawback here has been the drying up of such opportunities during most of the past decade. What about other bases of choice? In writing this book, we have made a series of experiments, each based on a single, fairly obvious criterion. The data used would be readily found in the Standard & Poor's stock guide. In all cases, a 30-stock portfolio was assumed to have been acquired at the 1968 closing prices and then revalued at June 30, 1971. The separate criteria applied were the following, as applied to otherwise random choices. 1. A low multiplier of recent earnings, not confined to DJIA issues. 2. A high dividend return. 3. A very long dividend record. 4. A very large enterprise, as measured by number of outstanding shares. 5. A strong financial position. 6. A low price in dollars per share. 7. A low price in relation to the previous high price. 8. A high quality ranking by Standard & Poor's. It'll be noted that the stock guide has at least one column relating to each of these criteria. This indicates the publisher's belief that each is of importance in analyzing and choosing common stocks. As we pointed out before, we should like to see another figure added, the net asset value per share. The most important fact that emerges from our various tests relates to the performance of stocks bought at random. We have tested this performance for three 30-stock portfolios, each made up of issues found on the first line of the December 31, 1968 stock guide, and also found in the issue for August 31, 1971. Between these two dates, the S&P composite was practically unchanged, and the DJIA lost about 5%. But our 90 randomly chosen issues declined an average of 22%, not counting 19 issues that were dropped from the guide and probably showed larger losses. These comparative results undoubtedly reflect the tendency of smaller issues of inferior quality to be relatively overvalued in bull markets, and not only to suffer more serious declines than the stronger issues in the ensuing price collapse, but also to delay their full recovery, in many cases indefinitely. The moral for the intelligent investor is, of course, to avoid second-quality issues in making up a portfolio, unless, for the enterprising investor, they are demonstrable bargains. Other results gleaned from our portfolio studies may be summarized as follows. Only three of the groups studied showed up better than the S&P composite, and hence better than the DJIA. 1. Industrials with the highest quality ranking, A+. These advanced 9.5% in the period against a decline of 2.4% for the S&P Industrials and 5.6% for the DJIA. However, the 10 public utility issues rated A+, declined 18% against a decline of 14% for the 55-stock S&P Public Utility Index. It is worth remarking that the S&P rankings showed up very well in this single test. In every case, a portfolio based on a higher ranking did better than a lower ranking portfolio. 2. Companies with more than 50 million shares outstanding showed no change on the whole, as against a small decline for the indexes. 3. Strangely enough, stocks selling at a high price per share, over 100, showed a slight 1% composite advance. Among our various tests, we made one based on book value, a figure not given in the stock guide. Here we found, contrary to our investment philosophy, that companies that combined major size with a large goodwill component in their market price did very well as a whole in the 2.5-year holding period. By goodwill component, we mean the part of the price that exceeds the book value. Our list of goodwill giants was made up of 30 issues, each of which had a goodwill component of over $1 billion, representing more than half of its market price. The total market value of these goodwill items at the end of 1968 was more than $120 billion. Despite these optimistic market valuations, the group as a whole showed a price advance per share of 15% between December 1968 and August 1971, and acquitted itself best among the 20-odd lists studied. A fact like this must not be ignored in a work on investment policies. It is clear that at the least a considerable momentum is attached to those companies that combine the virtues of great size, an excellent past record of earnings, the public's expectation of continued earnings growth in the future, and strong market action over many past years. Even if the price may appear excessive by our quantitative standards, the underlying market momentum may well carry such issues along more or less indefinitely. Naturally, this assumption does not apply to every individual issue in the category. For example, the indisputable goodwill leader, IBM, moved down from 315 to 304 in the 30-month period. It is difficult to judge to what extent the superior market action shown is due to true or objective investment merits, and to what extent to long-established popularity. No doubt both factors are important here. Clearly, both the long-term and the recent market action of the goodwill giants would recommend them for a diversified portfolio of common stocks. Our own preference, however, remains for other types that show a combination of favorable investment factors, including asset values of at least two-thirds the market price. The tests using other criteria indicate in general that random lists based on a single favorable factor did better than random lists chosen for the opposite factor. For example, low multiplier issues had a smaller decline in this period than high multiplier issues, and long-term dividend payers lost less than those that were not paying dividends at the end of 1968. To that extent, the results support our recommendation that the issues selected meet a combination of quantitative or tangible criteria. Finally, we should comment on the much poorer showing made by our lists as a whole, as compared with the price record of the S&P composite. The latter is weighted by the size of each enterprise, whereas our tests are based on taking one share of each company. Evidently, the larger emphasis given to giant enterprises by the S&P method made a significant difference in the results, and points up once again their greater price stability as compared with run-of-the-mine companies. Bargain issues or net current asset stocks. In the tests discussed before, we did not include the results of buying 30 issues at a price less than their net current asset value. The reason was that only a handful at most of such issues would have been found in the stock guide at the end of 1968. But the picture changed in the 1970 decline, and at the low prices of that year, a goodly number of common stocks could have been bought at below their working capital value. It always seemed, and still seems, ridiculously simple to say that if one can acquire a diversified group of common stocks at a price less than the applicable net current assets alone, after deducting all prior claims and counting as zero the fixed and other assets, the result should be quite satisfactory. They were so, in our experience, for more than 30 years. Say, between 1923 and 1957, excluding a time of real trial in 1930 through 1932. Has this approach any relevance at the beginning of 1971? Our answer would be a qualified yes. A quick runover of the stock guide would have uncovered some 50 or more issues that appeared to be obtainable at or below net current asset value. As might be expected, a good many of these had been doing badly in the difficult year 1970. If we eliminated those which had reported net losses in the last 12-month period, we would still be left with enough issues to make up a diversified list. We have included in Table 5-2, which can be found on the enhancement, some data on 5 issues that sold at less than their working capital value at their low prices of 1970. These give some food for reflection on the nature of stock price fluctuations. How does it come about that well-established companies, whose brands are household names all over the country, could be valued at such low figures, at the same time when other concerns, with better earnings growth of course, were selling for billions of dollars in excess of what their balance sheets showed? To quote the old days once more, the idea of goodwill as an element of intangible value was usually associated with a trade name. Names such as Lady Pepperell in sheets, Janssen in swimsuits, and Parker in pens would be considered assets of great value indeed. But now, if the market doesn't like a company, not only renowned trade names, but land, buildings, machinery, and what you will, can all count for nothing in its scales. Pascal said that the heart has its reasons that the reason doesn't understand. For heart, read Wall Street. There is another contrast that comes to mind. When the going is good and new issues are readily saleable, stock offerings of no quality at all make their appearance. They quickly find buyers. Their prices are often bid up enthusiastically right after issuance to levels in relation to assets and earnings that would put IBM, Xerox, and Polaroid to shame. Wall Street takes this madness in its stride, with no overt efforts by anyone to call a halt before the inevitable collapse in prices. The SEC can't do much more than insist on disclosure of information, about which the speculative public couldn't care less, or announce investigations and usually mild punitive actions of various sorts after the letter of the law has been clearly broken. When many of these minuscule but grossly inflated enterprises disappear from view, or nearly so, it is all taken philosophically enough as part of the game. Everybody swears off such inexcusable extravagances. Until next time. "Thanks for the lecture," says the gentle listener. "But what about your bargain issues? Can one really make money in them without taking a serious risk?" Yes, indeed. If you can find enough of them to make a diversified group, and if you don't lose patience if they fail to advance soon after you buy them. Sometimes the patience needed may appear quite considerable. In our previous edition, we hazarded a single example, which was current as we wrote. It was Burton Dixie Corporation, with stock selling at 20 against net current asset value of 30, and book value of about 50. A profit on that purchase would not have been immediate, but in August 1967, all the shareholders were offered 53¾ for their shares, probably at just about book value. A patient holder who had bought the shares in March 1964 at 20 would have had a profit of 165% in 3.5 years, a non-compounded annual return of 47%. Most of the bargain issues in our experience have not taken that long to show good profits, nor have they shown so high a rate. For a somewhat similar situation, current as we write, see our discussion of National Presto Industries. Special situations or workouts. Let us touch briefly on this area, since it is theoretically includable in the program of operations of an enterprising investor. It was commented upon before. Here we shall supply some examples of the genre and some further remarks on what it appears to offer an open-minded and alert investor. 3 such situations, among others, were current early in 1971, and they may be summarized as follows. Situation 1. Acquisition of Kaiser Roth by Borden's. In January 1971, Borden Incorporated announced a plan to acquire control of Kaiser Roth, Diversified Apparel, by giving 1 1/3 shares of its own stock in exchange for 1 share of Kaiser Roth. On the following day, in active trading, Borden closed at 26 and Kaiser Roth at 28. If an operator had bought 300 shares of Kaiser Roth and sold 400 Borden at these prices, and if the deal were later consummated on the announced terms, he would have had a profit of some 24% on the cost of his shares, less commissions and some other items. Assuming the deal had gone through in 6 months, his final profit might have been at about a 40% per annum rate. Situation 2. In November 1970, National Biscuit Company offered to buy control of Aurora Plastics Company at $11 in cash. The stock was selling at about 8.5. It closed the month at 9 and continued to sell there at year-end. Here the gross profit indicated was originally about 25%, subject to the risks of non-consummation and to the time element. Situation 3. Universal Marion Company, which had ceased its business operations, asked its shareholders to ratify dissolution of the concern. The treasurer indicated that the common stock had a book value of about $28.50 per share, a substantial part of which was in liquid form. The stock closed 1970 at 21.5, indicating a possible gross profit here if book value was realized in liquidation of more than 30%. If operations of this kind, conducted on a diversified basis for spreading the risk, could be counted to yield annual profits of, say, 20% or better, they would undoubtedly be more than merely worthwhile. Since this is not an audiobook on special situations, we are not going into the details of the business, for it really is a business. Let us point out two contradictory developments there in recent years. On the one hand, the number of deals to choose from has increased enormously, as compared with, say, 10 years ago. This is a consequence of what might be called a mania of corporations to diversify their activities through various types of acquisitions, etc. In 1970, the number of merger announcements aggregated some 5,000, down from over 6,000 in 1969. The total money values involved in these deals amounted to many, many billions. Perhaps only a small fraction of the 5,000 announcements could have presented a clear-cut opportunity for purchase of shares by a special situations man. But this fraction was still large enough to keep him busy studying, picking, and choosing. The other side of the picture is that an increasing proportion of the mergers announced failed to be consummated. In such cases, of course, the aimed-for profit is not realized, and is likely to be replaced by a more or less serious loss. Reasons for non-success are numerous, including antitrust intervention, shareholder opposition, change in market conditions, unfavorable indications from further study, inability to agree on details, and others. The trick here, of course, is to have the judgment, buttressed by experience, to pick the deals most likely to succeed, and also those which are likely to occasion the smallest loss if they fail. Further comment on the previous examples. Kaiser Roth. The directors of this company had already rejected, in January 1971, the Borden proposal when this chapter was written. If the operation had been undone immediately, the overall loss, including commissions, would have been about 12% of the cost of the Kaiser Roth shares. Aurora Plastics. Because of the bad showing of this company in 1970, the takeover terms were renegotiated and the price reduced to 10.5. The shares were paid for at the end of May. The annual rate of return realized here was about 25%. Universal Marion. This company promptly made an initial distribution in cash and stock worth about $7 per share, reducing the investment to, say, 14.5. However, the market price fell as low as 13 subsequently, casting doubt on the ultimate outcome of the liquidation. Assuming that the three examples given are fairly representative of workout or arbitrage opportunities as a whole in 1971, it is clear that they are not attractive if entered into upon a random basis. This has become more than ever a field for professionals, with the requisite experience and judgment. There is an interesting sidelight to our Kaiser Roth example. Late in 1971, the price fell below 20, while Borden was selling at 25, equivalent to 33 for Kaiser Roth under the terms of the exchange offer. It would appear that either the directors had made a great mistake in turning down that opportunity, or the shares of Kaiser Roth were now badly undervalued in the market. Something for a security analyst to look into. Commentary on Chapter 15. It is easy in the world to live after the world's opinion. It is easy in solitude to live after our own. But the great man is he who, in the midst of the crowd, keeps with perfect sweetness the independence of solitude. Ralph Waldo Emerson. Practice, practice, practice. Max Hein, founder of the Mutual Series Funds, liked to say that there are many roads to Jerusalem. What this masterly stock picker meant was that his own value-centered method of selecting stocks was not the only way to be a successful investor. In this chapter, we'll look at several techniques that some of today's leading money managers use for picking stocks. First, though, it's worth repeating that for most investors, selecting individual stocks is unnecessary, if not inadvisable. The fact that most professionals do a poor job of stock picking does not mean that most amateurs can do better. The vast majority of people who try to pick stocks learn that they are not as good at it as they thought. The luckiest ones discover this early on, while the less fortunate take years to learn it. A small percentage of investors can excel at picking their own stocks. Everyone else would be better off getting help, ideally through an index fund. Graham advised investors to practice first, just as even the greatest athletes and musicians practice and rehearse before every actual performance. He suggested starting off by spending a year tracking and picking stocks, but not with real money. In Graham's day, you would have practiced using a ledger of hypothetical buys and sells on a legal pad. Nowadays, you can use portfolio trackers at websites like www.morningstar.com, http://finance.yahoo.com, http://money.cnn.com/services/portfolio/. Or www.marketocracy.com. At the last site, ignore the market-beating hype on its funds and other services. By test-driving your techniques before trying them with real money, you can make mistakes without incurring any actual losses. Develop the discipline to avoid frequent trading. Compare your approach against those of leading money managers, and learn what works for you. Best of all, tracking the outcome of all your stock picks will prevent you from forgetting that some of your hunches turn out to be stinkers. That'll force you to learn from your winners and your losers. After a year, measure your results against how you would have done if you had put all your money in an S&P 500 index fund. If you didn't enjoy the experiment or your picks were poor, no harm done. Selecting individual stocks is not for you. Get yourself an index fund and stop wasting your time on stock picking. If you enjoyed the experiment and earned sufficiently good returns, gradually assemble a basket of stocks, but limit it to a maximum of 10% of your overall portfolio. Keep the rest in an index fund. And remember, you can always stop if it no longer interests you or your returns turn bad. Looking under the right rocks. So how should you go about looking for a potentially rewarding stock? You can use websites like http://finance.yahoo.com and www.morningstar.com to screen stocks with the statistical filters suggested in Chapter 14. Or you can take a more patient, craftsman-like approach. Unlike most people, many of the best professional investors first get interested in a company when its share price goes down, not up. Christopher Brown of Tweedy Brown Global Value Fund, William Nygren of the Oakmark Fund, Robert Rodriguez of FPA Capital Fund, and Robert Torre of the Torre Fund all suggest looking at the daily list of new 52-week lows in the Wall Street Journal or the similar table in the Market Week section of Barron's. That'll point you towards stocks and industries that are unfashionable or unloved and that thus offer the potential for high returns once perceptions change. Christopher Davis of the Davis Funds and William Miller of Legg Mason Value Trust like to see rising returns on invested capital, or ROIC, a way of measuring how efficiently a company generates what Warren Buffett has called owner earnings. By checking comparables, or the prices at which similar businesses have been acquired over the years, managers like Oakmarks Nigrin and Longleaf Partners O. Mason Hawkins get a better handle on what a company's parts are worth. For an individual investor, it's painstaking and difficult work. Start by looking at the business segment's footnote in the company's annual report, which typically lists the industrial sector, revenues, and earnings of each subsidiary. The management discussion and analysis may also be helpful. Then search a news database like Factiva, ProQuest, or LexisNexis for examples of other firms in the same industries that have recently been acquired. Using the EDGAR database at www.sec.gov to locate their past annual reports, you may be able to determine the ratio of purchase price to the earnings of those acquired companies. You can then apply that ratio to estimate how much a corporate acquirer might pay for a similar division of the company you're investigating. By separately analyzing each of the company's divisions this way, you may be able to see whether they are worth more than the current stock price. Longleaf's Hawkins likes to find what he calls 60-cent dollars, or companies whose stock is trading at 60% or less of the value at which he appraises the businesses. That helps provide the margin of safety that Graham insists on. Who's the boss? Finally, most leading professional investors want to see that a company is run by people who, in the words of Oakmark's William Nigrin, think like owners, not just managers. Two simple tests. Are the company's financial statements easily understandable, or are they full of obfuscation? Are non-recurring or extraordinary or unusual charges just that, or do they have a nasty habit of recurring? Longleaf's Mason Hawkins looks for corporate managers who are good partners, meaning that they communicate candidly about problems, have clear plans for allocating current and future cash flow, and own sizable stakes in the company's stock, preferably through cash purchases rather than through grants of options. But if managements talk more about the stock price than about the business, warns Robert Torre of the Torre Fund, we're not interested. Christopher Davis of the Davis Funds favors firms that limit issuance of stock options to roughly 3% of shares outstanding. At Vanguard PrimeCap Fund, Howard Cho tracks what the company said one year and what happened the next. We want to see not only whether managements are honest with shareholders, but also whether they're honest with themselves. If a company boss insists that all is hunky-dory when business is sputtering, watch out. Nowadays, you can listen in on a company's regularly scheduled conference calls, even if you own only a few shares. To find out the schedule, call the Investor Relations Department at corporate headquarters or visit the company's website. Robert Rodriguez of FPA Capital Fund turns to the back page of the company's annual report, where the heads of its operating divisions are listed. If there's a lot of turnover in those names in the first 1 or 2 years of a new CEO's regime, that's probably a good sign. He's cleaning out the dead wood. But if high turnover continues, the turnaround has probably devolved into turmoil. Keeping your eyes on the road. There are even more roads to Jerusalem than these. Some leading portfolio managers, like David Dremen of Dremen Value Management and Martin Whitman of the Third Avenue Funds, focus on companies selling at very low multiples of assets, earnings, or cash flow. Others, like Charles Royce of the Royce Funds and Joel Tillinghast of Fidelity Low-Priced Stock Fund, hunt for undervalued small companies. And for an all-too-brief look at how today's most revered investor, Warren Buffett, selects companies, see the sidebar on page 401. One technique that can be helpful. See which leading professional money managers own the same stocks you do. If one or two names keep turning up, go to the websites of those fund companies and download their most recent reports. By seeing which other stocks these investors own, you can learn more about what qualities they have in common. By reading the manager's commentary, you may get ideas on how to improve your own approach. No matter which techniques they use in picking stocks, successful investing professionals have two things in common. First, they are disciplined and consistent, refusing to change their approach even when it's unfashionable. Second, they think a great deal about what they do and how to do it, but they pay very little attention to what the market is doing. From EPS to ROIC. Net income or earnings per share, EPS, has been distorted in recent years by factors like stock option grants and accounting gains and charges. To see how much a company is truly earning on the capital it deploys in its businesses, look beyond EPS to ROIC, or return on invested capital. Christopher Davis of the Davis Funds defines it with this formula. ROIC equals owner earnings divided by invested capital, where owner earnings is equal to operating profit plus depreciation plus amortization of goodwill minus federal income tax paid at the company's average rate minus cost of stock options minus maintenance or essential capital expenditures minus any income generated by unsustainable rates of return on pension funds. As of 2003, anything greater than 6.5%. And where invested capital is equal to total assets minus cash, as well as short-term investments and non-interest-bearing current liabilities, plus past accounting charges that reduced invested capital. ROIC has the virtue of showing, after all legitimate expenses, what the company earns from its operating businesses, and how efficiently it has used the shareholders' money to generate that return. An ROIC of at least 10% is attractive. Even 6% or 7% can be tempting if the company has good brand names, focused management, or is under a temporary cloud. Warren's Way. Graham's greatest student, Warren Buffett, has become the world's most successful investor by putting new twists on Graham's ideas. Buffett and his partner Charles Munger have combined Graham's margin of safety and detachment from the market with their own innovative emphasis on future growth. Here is an all-too-brief summary of Buffett's approach. He looks for what he calls franchise companies with strong consumer brands, easily understandable businesses, robust financial health, and near monopolies in their markets, like H&R Block, Gillette, and the Washington Post Company. Buffett likes to snap up a stock when a scandal, big loss, or other bad news passes over it like a storm cloud, as when he bought Coca-Cola soon after its disastrous rollout of New Coke and the market crash of 1987. He also wants to see managers who set and meet realistic goals, build their businesses from within rather than through acquisition, allocate capital wisely, and do not pay themselves $100 million jackpots of stock options. Buffett insists on steady and sustainable growth in earnings, so the company will be worth more in the future than it is today. In his annual reports, archived at www.berkshirehathaway.com, Buffett has set out his thinking like an open book. Probably no other investor, Graham included, has publicly revealed more about his approach or written such compellingly readable essays. One classic Buffett proverb: when a management with a reputation for brilliance tackles a business with a reputation for bad economics, it is the reputation of the business that remains intact. Every intelligent investor can and should learn by reading this master's own words.
Chapter 16. Convertible Issues and Warrants.
Convertible bonds and preferred stocks have been taking on a predominant importance in recent years in the field of senior financing. As a parallel development, stock option warrants, which are long-term rights to buy common shares at stipulated prices, have become more and more numerous. More than half the preferred issues now quoted in the Standard & Poor's Stock Guide have conversion privileges, and this has been true also of a major part of the corporate bond financing in 1968 through 1970. There are at least 60 different series of stock option warrants dealt in on the American Stock Exchange. In 1970, for the first time in its history, the New York Stock Exchange listed an issue of long-term warrants, giving rights to buy 31,400,000 American Tellantel shares at $52 each. With Mother Bell now leading that procession, it is bound to be augmented by many new fabricators of warrants. As we shall point out later, they are a fabrication in more than one sense. In the overall picture, the convertible issues rank as much more important than the warrants, and we shall discuss them first. There are two main aspects to be considered from the standpoint of the investor. First, how do they rank as investment opportunities and risks? Second, how does their existence affect the value of the related common stock issues? Convertible issues are claimed to be especially advantageous to both the investor and the issuing corporation. The investor receives the superior protection of a bond or preferred stock, plus the opportunity to participate in any substantial rise in the value of the common stock. The issuer is able to raise capital at a moderate interest or preferred dividend cost, and if the expected prosperity materializes, the issuer will get rid of the senior obligation by having it exchanged into common stock. Thus, both sides to the bargain will fare unusually well. Obviously, the foregoing paragraph must overstate the case somewhere, for you cannot, by a mere ingenious device, make a bargain much better for both sides. In exchange for the conversion privilege, the investor usually gives up something important in quality or yield, or both. Conversely, if the company gets its money at lower cost because of the conversion feature, it is surrendering in return part of the common shareholders' claim to future enhancement. On this subject, there are a number of tricky arguments to be advanced both pro and con. The safest conclusion that can be reached is that convertible issues are like any other form of security, and that their form itself guarantees neither attractiveness nor unattractiveness. That question will depend on all the facts surrounding the individual issue. We do know, however, that a group of convertible issues floated during the latter part of a bull market are bound to yield unsatisfactory results as a whole. It is at such optimistic periods, unfortunately, that most of the convertible financing has been done in the past. The poor consequences must be inevitable, from the timing itself, since a wide decline in the stock market must invariably make the conversion privilege much less attractive, and often also call into question the underlying safety of the issue itself. As a group illustration, we shall retain the example used in our first edition of the relative price behavior of convertible and straight, non-convertible, preferreds offered in 1946, the closing year of the bull market preceding the extraordinary one that began in 1949. A comparable presentation is difficult to make for the years 1967 through 1970. Because there were virtually no new offerings of non-convertibles in those years. But it is easy to demonstrate that the average price decline of convertible preferred stocks from December 1967 to December 1970 was greater than that for common stocks as a whole, which lost only 5%. Also, the convertibles seem to have done quite a bit worse than the older straight preferred shares during the period December 1968 to December 1970. As is shown by the sample of 20 issues of each kind in Table 16-2, which can be found on the enhancement. These comparisons would demonstrate that convertible securities as a whole have relatively poor quality as senior issues, and also are tied to common stocks that do worse than the general market, except during a speculative upsurge. These observations do not apply to all convertible issues, of course. In the 1968 and 1969 particularly, a fair number of strong companies used convertible issues to combat the inordinately high interest rates for even first-quality bonds. But it is noteworthy that in our 20-stock sample of convertible preferreds, only one showed an advance, and 14 suffered bad declines. The conclusion to be drawn from these figures is not that convertible issues are in themselves less desirable than non-convertible or straight securities. Other things being equal, the opposite is true. But we clearly see that other things are not equal in practice, and that the addition of the conversion privilege often, perhaps generally, betrays an absence of genuine investment quality for the issue. It is true, of course, that a convertible preferred is safer than the common stock of the same company. That is to say, it carries smaller risk of eventual loss of principal. Consequently, those who buy new convertibles instead of the corresponding common stock are logical to that extent. But in most cases, the common would not have been an intelligent purchase to begin with, at a ruling price, and the substitution of the convertible preferred did not improve the picture sufficiently. Furthermore, a good deal of the buying of convertibles was done by investors who had no special interest or confidence in the common stock. That is, they would never have thought of buying the common at the time, but who were tempted by what seemed an ideal combination of a prior claim plus a conversion privilege close to the current market. In a number of instances, this combination has worked out well, but the statistics seem to show that it is more likely to prove a pitfall. In connection with the ownership of convertibles, there is a special problem which most investors fail to realize. Even when a profit appears, it brings a dilemma with it. Should the holder sell on a small rise? Should he hold for a much bigger advance? If the issue is called, as often happens when the common has gone up considerably, should he sell out then, or convert into and retain the common stock? Let us talk in concrete terms. You buy a 6% bond at 100, convertible into stock at 25, that is, at the rate of 40 shares for each $1,000 bond. The stock goes to 30, which makes the bond worth at least 120, and so it sells at 125. You either sell or hold. If you hold, hoping for a higher price, you are pretty much in the position of a common shareholder, since if the stock goes down, your bond will go down too. A conservative person is likely to say that beyond 125, his position has become too speculative, and therefore he sells and makes a gratifying 25% profit. So far, so good. But pursue the matter a bit. In many cases where the holder sells at 125, the common stock continues to advance, carrying the convertible with it, and the investor experiences that peculiar pain that comes to the man who is sold out much too soon. The next time he decides to hold for 150 or 200. The issue goes up to 140 and he does not sell. Then the market breaks and his bond slides down to 80. Again, he has done the wrong thing. Aside from the mental anguish involved in making these bad guesses, and they seem to be almost inevitable, there is a real arithmetical drawback to operations in convertible issues. It may be assumed that a stern and uniform policy of selling at 25% or 30% profit will work out best as applied to many holdings. This would then mark the upper limit of profit and would be realized only on the issues that worked out well. But if, as appears to be true, these issues often lack adequate underlying security and tend to be floated and purchased in the latter stages of a bull market, then a goodly proportion of them will fail to rise to 125, but will not fail to collapse when the market turns downward. Thus, the spectacular opportunities in convertibles prove to be illusory in practice, and the overall experience is marked by fully as many substantial losses, at least of a temporary kind, as there are gains of similar magnitude. Because of the extraordinary length of the 1950 through 1968 bull market, convertible issues as a whole gave a good account of themselves for some 18 years, but this meant only that the great majority of common stocks enjoyed large advances, in which most convertible issues were able to share. The soundness of investment in convertible issues can only be tested by their performance in a declining stock market, and this has always proved disappointing as a whole. In our first edition, 1949, we gave an illustration of this special problem of what to do with a convertible when it goes up. We believe it still merits inclusion here. Like several of our references, it is based on our own investment operations. We were members of a select group, mainly of investment funds, who participated in a private offering of convertible 4.5% debentures of Eversharp Company at par, convertible into common stock at $40 per share. The stock advanced rapidly to 65.5, and then, after a 3-for-2 split, to the equivalent of 88. The latter price made the convertible debentures worth no less than $220. During this period, the two issues were called at a small premium, hence they were practically all converted into common stock, which was retained by a number of the original investment fund buyers of the debentures. The price promptly began a severe decline, and in March 1948, the stock sold as low as 7 3/8. This represented a value of only 27 for the debenture issues, or a loss of 75% of the original price, instead of a profit of over 100%. The real point of this story is that some of the original purchasers converted their bonds into the stock and held the stock through its great decline. In so doing, they ran counter to an old maxim of Wall Street, which runs, "Never convert a convertible bond." Why this advice? Because once you convert, you've lost your strategic combination of prior claimant to interest, plus a chance for an attractive profit. You've probably turned from investor into speculator, and quite often at an unpropitious time, because the stock has already had a large advance. If never convert a convertible is a good rule, how came it that these experienced fund managers exchanged their Eversharp bonds for stock, to their subsequent embarrassing loss? The answer, no doubt, is that they let themselves be carried away by enthusiasm for the company's prospects, as well as by the favorable market action of the shares. Wall Street has a few prudent principles. The trouble is that they're always forgotten when they're most needed. Hence that other famous dictum of the old-timers: do as I say, not as I do. Our general attitude toward new convertible issues is thus a mistrustful one. We mean here, as in other similar observations, that the investor should look more than twice before he buys them. After such hostile scrutiny, he may find some exceptional offerings that are too good to refuse. The ideal combination, of course, is a strongly secured convertible, exchangeable for a common stock, which itself is attractive, and at a price only slightly higher than the current market. Every now and then a new offering appears that meets these requirements. By the nature of the securities markets, however, you're more likely to find such an opportunity in some older issue which has developed into a favorable position, rather than in a new flotation. If a new issue is a really strong one, it is not likely to have a good conversion privilege. The fine balance between what is given and what is withheld in a standard-type convertible issue is well illustrated by the extensive use of this type of security in the financing of American Telephone and Telegraph Company. Between 1913 and 1957, the company sold at least 9 separate issues of convertible bonds, most of them through subscription rights to shareholders. The convertible bonds had the important advantage to the company of bringing in a much wider class of buyers than would have been available for a stock offering, since the bonds were popular with many financial institutions, which possess huge resources, but some of which were not permitted to buy stocks. The interest return on the bonds has generally been less than half the corresponding dividend yield on the stock, a factor that was calculated to offset the prior claim of the bondholders. Since the company maintained its $9 dividend rate for 40 years, from 1919 to the stock split in 1959, the result was the eventual conversion of virtually all the convertible issues into common stock. Thus, the buyers of these convertibles have fared well through the years. but not quite so well as if they had bought the capital stock in the first place. This example establishes the soundness of American telephone and telegraph, but not the intrinsic attractiveness of convertible bonds. To prove them sound in practice, we should need to have a number of instances in which the convertible worked out well, even though the common stock proved disappointing. Such instances are not easy to find.